Good morning. This is Dave Weiner, and this is a special recording for the conference in Pisa. For everybody that's listening, this will also be listened to by people on scripting.com. What happened was Murphy's Law, which says anything that can go wrong will go wrong. Well, Murphy's Law ruled the day today, and we were unable to actually make the video conference work. So what I've agreed to do in place of giving a live talk is to use some reliable technology, MP3, and to record the presentation and then upload it to a server and then provide the link to the people running the conference, and then they will play it for the people in the room. With my apologies, I really wish that I could have been there today. And of course, it would have been a lot more interesting. Hopefully, we would have actually been able to have a discussion, which is what I prefer to actually just giving a talk. So, I have several things that I want to talk about today. And if you want to follow along, the URL for my talk is http://DaveTravel, DaveTravel dot scripting, scripting.com slash PISA notes, PISANOTES. So who am I? My name is Dave Weiner and I'm a resident of Florida. I'm a software developer. I'm a blogger. I invent things. I'm a college graduate, and I have a master's degree in computer science. I've developed outlining tools, presentation tools, scripting systems, blogging tools, aggregators or feed readers, and I've designed formats and protocols including XML RPC, SOAP, RSS, and OPML. I've won some awards, and I used to be a research fellow at Berkman Center at Harvard Law School, and I'm a former contributing editor for Wired. So, one of the things I want to talk about, since the topic is user communities and their tools, is the idea of an unconference. And this is something that we developed in a format that we called BloggerCon, which was a conference for bloggers. We've done three of them. We did two at Harvard Law School and one at Stanford Law School. And the first one was sort of the evolutionary one, where we did the conference sort of the usual way with panels and speakers, and but with a heavy emphasis on discussion, because it was a blogging conference. We felt that if you're going to put a room full of bloggers together, that we would want to hear what they all said, what they all think. And it was sort of based on the premise that I'm just going to let, this is my cell phone, by the way, and my ringtone. I'm just going to let it ring. Anyway, our premise was that when you have a conference, that if you were to add up all the intelligence in the room, you would find that most of it is not up on stage. While you try to get very smart people to speak, it's still, there are so many more people in what we call the audience, that we ought to try to tap in to the intelligence and their enthusiasm and their ideas. Not just because there's more of it, but also because we were curious about this phenomenon that happens when you put a conference together. It seems all the interesting conversations take place in the hallways. And so the thought was that if we could involve the people that were in the audience more, that we might get a better conference. So it was a 2-day conference, then that was the way the first day was. And the second day, we went even more extreme. And we said no panels, no speakers. And we had this idea that you would have a discussion leader and that their job would be much like a reporter putting together a story, and that the people in the room were the sources, and that the discussion leader would try to assemble a story out of the expertise of the people in the room. And this changed some of the basic rules. of conference going, and we felt a very good way, because one of the things that happens at a conference is that you have a speaker like what I'm doing right now, and people sort of formulate their questions while I'm speaking, and then at the end they line up in front of a microphone and wait their turn to ask a question, and even if they didn't have a question, even if they just wanted to make a point. And all the time they're sitting there waiting, they're composing a speech and they're getting nervous, and what they're going to say gets longer and longer and longer, and people go out into the hallway to have the real conversations. And a funny thing happened in the second day of BloggerCon, where we had this sort of unconference format. The interesting conversations took place in the room. And so at the second BloggerCon, we completely did away with the format of speakers and panels and Q&A, and just went with a discussion format and perfected that in the third BloggerCon that we did at Stanford, which was late in 2004. And since then, the format has been emulated by other conference promoters with great success, to the point where some people don't even want to go to the old kind of conference anymore, because this way of doing it is so much more, makes better use of their time and is so much more interesting. And if you think about it, it's a lot like the blogosphere, in that the blogosphere sort of decentralized the whole idea of information flow and idea flow, that you didn't need to get a job with a big publication in order to have your ideas heard. All you had to do was get a weblog. And so this goes back to why I started blogging. And, depending on what you think a blog is, I either started blogging in 1994 or in 1996 or in 1997, but it was pretty early. And while there are some question about who was the first blogger, I was certainly among the first bloggers, and my blog served as the model for many of the what we consider the early weblogs. And my reason was because I wanted, well, go back to the beginning of why did I get involved in the internet in the first place, is that it seemed to me that this was from a software developer standpoint, which is one of the hats that I wear, one of the things that I do. It seemed to me like the platform without the platform vendor, which meant that nobody controlled what you could do, and which meant that it could be a place of great creativity. And it turns out that while there are many people and companies that would like to be the platform vendor of the internet, that it pretty much has maintained that over the years. And in fact, wherever the internet has been successful, it's been precisely because of that. Because there was never anybody that could control what people used the internet for, it meant that basically it became a place of great creativity and lots of interesting new economic models and social models. I started, which I'll get to a little bit more in a bit when I talk about monoculture. But I started blogging for the simple reason, or I started using the internet to communicate for the simple reason that I had a story to tell and I couldn't get the reporters to tell the story. And it goes back to the Macintosh platform when it was competing with Windows. And the conventional wisdom amongst reporters was that there was no Macintosh software. And of course, I was a creator of Macintosh software, and actually, more specifically, it was that there was no new Macintosh software. And I knew many of the reporters, and I would call them up and say, "Come on, you know that there's a lot of new software for the Macintosh because you use it." And they say, "Oh, yeah, I use all that stuff. It's cool." And then you say, "Well, why do you report that there's no new Macintosh software?" And they would say, "Well, but everybody knows that there's no new Macintosh software." And I don't think that they were dishonest. I just think that they didn't understand that conventional wisdom, that you shouldn't report conventional wisdom, was my belief. You should report the truth. And that if there is new Macintosh software, then your reports should say there is new Macintosh software. But there was nothing that we could do about it. The reporters were constantly saying that there was nothing new, which made it really difficult to, market new software for the Macintosh. So I started communicating directly, and lo and behold, more new Macintosh software started getting created, and a very, very important principle developed from this, which is that the use of the web to route around centralized authority. And you see it happening everywhere. For example, if you were to book a trip, you might have 10 years ago, you might have used a travel agent to book the trip. But today, you probably would use Expedia and Hotwire maybe and Travelocity, or you might go directly to the airline. Some airlines in the US, like Southwest, offered very deep discounts. In Europe, you have Ryanair that's doing the same thing. We sort of put together our own vacations now. And it takes more time than it used to take on our part, but we can save money and we can get better trips and we get to go where we really wanted to go in the first place. I used to find when I used a travel agent that I would go end up being booked at resorts that have great golf courses, and which was useless to me because I don't play golf, but my travel agent did play golf. And that's why she, like the reporter who reports that there's no new Macintosh software, the travel agent can't necessarily see their even see their own filters and understand why they're making the choices that they make, but yet they make those choices, and they may not be the choices that we want made on our behalf. So the internet creates this opportunity for us to make our own choices, for us to do our own reporting, to get our own story out there. And to hear directly from the people who have the knowledge without the intermediary, or to book our trip on the airline without going through a travel agent. And that's just one of many such things that are going on. eBay, for example, is a whole economy that's based on this idea that we don't need the middlemen anymore, that we can do our own shopping and we can do our own marketing and our own distribution. And this is creating a phenomenon that that makes us ever more hungry for information. And if you think about it, in the last 10 years or so, our expectations for information have just gone through the roof. Think about the trip that you might have booked in let's say 1992. Let's say you were going to go to London, or you're in the United States, you would go to Chicago. And you wanted to know what clothes you should bring with you, or you wanted to book some theater tickets. You wanted to know what was playing, or if your favorite sports team was in town, maybe buy some tickets for that. In 1992, your expectation, you might have been able to find out what the temperature was yesterday in Chicago or in London, but the other information, you would have had to have gone to the library, and the information would have been old, and you wouldn't be getting information about the future. You'd only be getting it about the past. In other words, we have moved from an age of information poverty into an age of information excess in an incredibly short period of time. In 10 or 15 years, not only has the amount of information gone up, but our expectation of information has gone up dramatically. At the same time, the economics of providing information have changed such that there isn't, if you look at the reporters and the news networks, the newspapers and the magazines, they're cutting back. They have less reporters than they used to have before because the economics are forcing them to do that. So you have this weird situation where, as our expectations for information are exploding, okay, at the same time, the cost or the amount of reporters available to provide that information is shrinking. And so that gap is being filled somewhere by commercial vendors, by we're doing it for ourselves. And there are other businesses that are being started that are incentivized to provide us with that information. And at the same time, we've invented some techniques for automating the gathering of that kind of information so that we can consume even more information as if that were the problem that we have. Well, it actually turns out that it is. And the technology that has been created for that is called RSS, And RSS stands for Really Simple Syndication. And it's become enormously popular. And every year since its inception has been sort of the watershed year for RSS. And this year, of course, is no exception. All the major news organizations support it. All of the blogging tools support it. You're finding that government agencies are providing feeds across the board. The network that's being created right now is the RSS network, and the tools that are being created to consume, to use that information are just exploding. And, you know, the BBC, actually I did the interview with the BBC that created, that characterizes, we characterized it as a sushi restaurant conveyor belt. If you can imagine, you know, if you've ever eaten at a sushi restaurant where you sit down and they just put these beautiful little plates of sushi in front of you, and you pick the ones that you want, and they charge you for them. That's sort of like how RSS works. You subscribe to all these different feeds, and all these news items just flow right by you, and you see one that you find interesting, say, I think I'll go look deeper into that. You click on it, and you get the whole story. And you can, when you do that, you don't have to go looking for the news. It comes to you. And you can think of RSS as automated web surfing. In other words, you create this sort of relationship between yourself and the news source and say, I want to be informed whenever there's something new on this topic. So, for example, I subscribe to the New York Times technology feed, or the BBC World News feed, or Engadget, which is a gadget website, a technology website, or Boing Boing, which is a style and technology sort of, you know, curiosity, you might think of it, curiosity web feed. My own site, Scripting News, scripting.com, has a feed. You'll find pretty much that any blog or any news source these days has a feed, and that more and more people are subscribing. The BBC, for example, has a goal that at the end of this year, by the end of this year, 10% of their clicks they expect will come from RSS feeds. There have been estimates that in 3 years, the New York Times, 25% of their clicks will come from RSS feeds. So the growth amongst people that are avid users of news, avid users of information, which are people who use the web very effectively, it's an absolute explosion right now. So where does this lead, and what are the changes that come about from this new, all these different new ways of communicating? You know, the unconference, the blog, RSS. Where does all this go, and how is this changing things? And the answer, I think, is that, well, first of all, we all grew up in the 20th century. If you're alive today and an adult, that won't be true for very much longer. I just turned 50, and as you grow older, well, time accelerates, and strange things happen, like people who were born in the 80s are adults now. And I, of course, was an adult in the 80s. That seems kind of weird. And there will come a day when I won't be able to say that, that if you're listening to me now, that you were born in the 20th century. But for now, it's true. And in the 20th century, the innovation was centralization. And the reason why was, in order to communicate on a large scale to lots of people, you needed, there was a certain sense of exclusivity because the means of communication were so expensive. If you wanted to broadcast, if you wanted to be on the radio, you had to take a job working for a radio station because it cost millions of dollars to set up a radio station, and we didn't have that kind of money as people, as personal. We didn't have that kind of money. If you wanted to write for publication, for print, you needed to work for a magazine or a newspaper, all the way up until the late 80s when the desktop publishing revolution happened, at which point the cost of a laser printer went down to under $10,000. And all of a sudden, you started seeing rapid change in the publishing industry because it became more and more accessible, to the point where today, the cost of a website, which is the equivalent of a magazine or a newspaper, the cost is virtually zero. you basically need a personal computer, which most people have anyway, in order to do the writing. And the serving for a weblog basically is zero, unless you have a huge flow weblog, in which case it's a few dollars a month. The cost is not the prohibitive factor anymore. Cost is virtually free. The same thing's true with radio. If you wanted to produce what we call a podcast, which has just become very popular in the last year, this art form called podcasting, you need basically a personal computer. Many of them come with built-in microphones. You need recording software, which costs about $30. On the Macintosh, it comes bundled with the operating system. And the server cost is a little bit more than it is for a weblog, but the cost is coming down at a very rapid pace, to the point where probably in a couple of years, maybe even sooner, the cost will virtually be free again. This cost of being a part of the radio network now is basically is almost as cheap as it is to be a writer on the internet. And so what that means is that ideas can come from users. And, you know, in the old days, a product was designed by a company. And the company had all these layers of insulation that kept the users away from the people who did the product design. So the products were crude approximations of what users wanted. But now, the users are on the verge of becoming product designers themselves. And in some areas, they are the product designers. If you look at photography, if you look at writing for the web, the users are having enormous influence over the design of the products. With eBay, the marketing and the distribution and the salesmanship and all those aspects are now in the hands of the users. It's only a matter of time before the manufacturers become fulfillment houses where they know exactly what the users want and can create it in very, very rapid fashion. The emergence of things like Engadget or Gizmodo are clues as well, because there are so many people that are qualified to write for these publications now. The cost of producing the publication is virtually zero, and these people are indistinguishable from product designers. And one day they're going to wake up and realize that they've got more good ideas about where the product should go than the people who are designing the product. That day is not very far away. So I think what we're seeing now is the driving of our economy, our social life, all aspects of what we do are being driven away from centralization and towards this distributed, decentralized, everybody's equally empowered to be creative world, which, you know, some people say, well, human nature can't change that. You just can't change the way people work. And this actually came up at the first BloggerCon. Esther Dyson, famous analyst and venture capitalist, she said, well, you know, can't change human nature. And I said, well, maybe we're not changing human nature. Maybe we're going back to the way things were before they were centralized. Back before you had radio stations and before you had record companies and before you had television and movie theaters, we all had to provide our own entertainment. I mean, if you wanted to hear music on a Saturday night, you either had to do the music yourself or you had to have a friend or a family member nearby who would play for you or sing for you. And didn't we lose something when we all stopped being creative and we all started thinking that you had to be somebody special, somebody extremely talented or extremely beautiful in order to have the joy of being creative? And yeah, I think we did lose something. And I think that we desperately need to get back to being creative, because our world has problems that can only be solved by creativity, and they need to be solved by all of us. And so this may well be the next step in the evolution of our species. It may be that big a deal, what we're doing right now. So, exciting time to be alive. I wish I were there with you in Pisa so I could say, let's have a great discussion about this now. But if you want, send me an email, dave.winer, W-I-N-E-R, @gmail.com. I'll tell you what, I'll put up a place for comments on this speech This is also going to be the Morning Coffee Notes podcast for May 11th, 2000, or I'm sorry, May 12th, 2005. And if you're a regular listener to my podcast, you may be disappointed to find out that there's no singing on this podcast. But I promise to do some singing on an upcoming one real soon. And if you want to read my site, my blog is www.scripting.com. And if you want to subscribe to my RSS feed, it's www.scripting.com/rss.xml. So everybody in Pisa and everybody around the world, I hope you have a great day. It's been great talking with you, and I'll see you again real soon. Take care. Bye.